talking to George Craig on the 19th of March, 2009, in case posterity happens to be interested, and after some 20-odd years. And I'll start off by asking what I have asked everybody else that I've interviewed of this, because it seems like a good way to get into it. How did you happen to become involved with KPFA in the first place?
I was a student at Berkeley High School, and I was involved in their radio program, which had I think it was half hour, an hour show on KRE, the AM station in Berkeley. And we produced this show and aired it there. Sometimes we did the production at their studios, but more often at the high school production studios. And I'd heard of KPFA, and I think I had listened to it some, but I didn't know too much about its inner workings. I think one of the teachers at the high school said that I ought to go up there and volunteer, since I was interested in broadcasting, interested in communication, interested in the electronic side. Mm-hmm. So I went up there and talked to Erwin Goldsmith, who was the chief engineer at that time, told him my interest.
Can you put a date on this?
It would have been around 1958 or 1959. Mm-hmm. I was pretty young. I was probably 18, 19, something like that. Mm-hmm. And so we had a good conversation and talked about things that they were doing and things I might be able to be interested in doing. And I started there volunteering after school, doing some things in the engineering department in terms of maintenance, and also started doing some production stuff.
Did you have a background in electronic engineering before you went there?
I had been interested for years. My father was kind of an amateur audiophile. He built his own high-fidelity equipment. He subscribed to a magazine called Audio Engineering.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
And they had schematics, drawings, and information about both products that were available for purchase, and they also had the same kind of information about things you could build yourself. And at that time, there was probably more of the homebrew type projects in the magazine than commercial products. So he built his own amplifiers and tuners and stuff for quite a few years, sort of evolving. Built his own speakers, you know, you buy the components and put them together.
And did you have the sort of relationship with him where he sort of taught you as you went along a bit? Did you learn from him?
I think very early on he took me to either San Francisco Radio or Zach Electronics in San Francisco, and we bought all the parts to make a 5-2 radio. It's probably just a little table model thing, which I guess I think they had parts of maybe some kind of assembly instructions. That was a long time ago. I don't remember quite how it all came together, but that was kind of our first sort of joint project, was making this radio. Now I sort of followed his footsteps in building my own monophonic hi-fi gear at the time, and later on moved into stereo. So that was sort of the beginning of my interest in the sound portion of it and trying to get things to sound better. And one of my interests in going to KPFA was to try to capture sound better, to get in on the recording side of the business, of the broadcast side. And the first project I worked on in the size was the Carmel Bach Festival. We used to broadcast that live. I think it was probably a 5 kilohertz telephone service at the time, so it wasn't real broadband by any means. I don't think you could get 15 kilohertz out there. I think the only reason we could get 5 is they had the golf tournament, Gordon Crosby thing in that area, so I think that's why the facilities were there for pretty decent quality telephone service.
Yeah. And then you were involved later on with the landline to Harris Hall, weren't you, for noon concert broadcasts and that stuff.
Yeah, involved with those. And then later on, we got involved with the Brio Music Festival and Lou Harris and all the Gerhard Samuel and all the great people that were involved in the music world in the Bay Area. Yeah.
Now that led you into doing recording for commercial recording for LP, Song for These People as well, didn't it?
Yeah. In fact, just about 2 weeks ago, Jennifer was on the internet and found that a Lou Harrison recording was available on CD, and my name was on the back of that. I was one of the masters. Mm-hmm. I made. Did quite a bit of work with Lou Harrison. He's a fun, interesting, creative guy. Lots of fun.
Yeah. And you are, you're a good friend of Charles and Lindsay Scheer as well, aren't you? You've traveled together.
Yeah, we've done that, and we've also, we're involved in a lot of Oakland Symphony broadcasts, doing that.
Gerhard Samuel.
Charles used to be the voice of the symphony for quite a few years. I can't remember how many music people. I know Charles definitely was involved. Probably. I don't know if that series went past his time at KPFA or whether Charles O'Connor was involved. I kind of forget where the changes in those things happened versus that project.
Were you still there when Charles Amerikanian came in?
Yes.
Ah, so there you had some overlap with him. You're probably aware that his project is OM Radio, Other Minds Radio, has acquired the entire KPFA music archive.
There's a couple hours of my work in there.
Innumerable. It was all going to be carted away for landfill. Nobody was interested. When they moved into the new building, you remember the size of that archive. It covered the whole walls of the main studio ultimately. But they got them all, and they are in the process of digitizing and getting them up onto this website called was it OM Radio, something like that, it can be they can be listened to by the general public, freely available, and.
That's pretty nice, because there were some great performances and great musicians in those times. A lot of really interesting contemporary classical stuff. John Cage and Lou Harrison just immediately spring to mind, but there were hundreds of other interesting young people creating stuff.
Yeah, there was that big John Cage festival, I remember, over in Divisadero Street, back in the early 60s. I remember when I came onto the studio it was Chris Koch that hired me, but then Ernie Lowe was sort of my boss for a short time, and then I, you remember, took over as production director, and when I came in, it was obvious that even by that time, 1962, you were essentially the person that was doing the serious music recording at the studio, pretty much.
Yeah, there was a fellow named Jimmy Connor who was involved with that before I was. But he drifted away for one reason or another. I don't recall why. He used to do the midnight special, the Kirk Curio show that went on. I think it was Friday nights, if I remember correctly.
I did that a few times. I mean, everybody got involved with that at one stage or another. And of course, it was Gert that brought together what ultimately became the Grateful Dead. Phil Lesh and Jerry Garcia sort of played together on the air for the first time on her program, and the Grateful Dead took off from that, and of course they continued to acknowledge their debt to KPFA, right up to the present. They're still involved with it, doing regular programming, one sort or another. Yeah, there was so much went through that station. I don't know if you had a chance to look at the website that I set up.
I did look at it. It's been a while since I did. Yeah. It was kind of interesting looking at that and seeing some of the various people remembering things that were going on. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of really strong characters in KPFA's
history. They're terrific.
One of the people that I remember very distinctly was Elsinite Thompson.
Oh, yeah.
I guess I was pretty young, so she was a little intimidating figure for me.
She was intimidating to everybody.
But she had such a history. I mean, she was right here in London during the war, which must have been a pretty frightening experience for a young woman, because she hadn't been very old at that time.
Well, she was old enough so that during the war, she was one of the BBC's principal voices on the World Service news, and she was
still gonna be frightening.
she was one of the first people to go on the air with reports from the concentration camps when they were entered and discovered.
That must have been a pretty nasty experience.
Oh, yeah.
No, not that.
You're close, but not.
Not that.
Yeah. She, just by one of life's amazing coincidences. I'm in correspondence just the last few days with a German radio producer, woman, who had got in touch with me, who is planning to do a couple of radio programs, one on Elsinite Thompson and one on Kenneth Rexroth. And she was put on to me as somebody that she ought to talk to, I've been able to supply her already with quite a bit, and she's coming over to talk with me later. There are people continue to be interested, and
I think it was an evolutionary period.
As I said, this thing which I just set up on my own just a few months ago, and already if you do a Google search on KPFA history, you get 50, 60, 70,000 hits or so, and my site comes up number two after KPFA's own website, and I've had. I've got counters on it, and I've had somewhere well over 5,000 hits in just a few months. Now that doesn't compare with pop groups or anything, but considering how many people there are in the world who aren't interested in KPFA, I'm quite amazed.
What do you think about the university and the number of people that sort of, if you will, cycled through Berkeley during the 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s? People from all over the world come there and they learn and they go away when they take that away as one of their experiences, because it touches most people in the Bay Area, I think.
Yeah. It's... Well, it's not what it used to be, but then a spin-off from KPFA in Pacifica is one of the most important broadcasters, on the air and online at all. I don't know if you know Democracy Now.
No.
It's run by run by two people, Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez, and they were both WBAI people, the program started as a Pacifica program in the first place, radio program, and then when in one of those many periods when Pacifica was completely falling apart and people were slaughtering each other, they pulled out and set up independently and started getting the program onto other stations. And it's televised, but it's recorded in such a way. It's all conversation, so it works equally well on radio as on television. And it's carried now by somewhere in excess of 500 stations around America. But it is also available online, you can just go in and either watch it or listen to it. And of course, there's so many people around, and particularly in America these days, that don't have broadband, for whom watching television online is just impossible. And not only that, but they have a crew of secretaries who transcribe all of these interviews, and they're almost instantaneously available, on the screen, transcribed without having to either look at them or listen to them, and. They get everybody. There are really top people now that are offering the best economic advice. Paul Goodman, the professor who won the Nobel Prize in Economics last year, columnist for the New York Times. He's on there with some regularity, and of course Nader and anybody you can think of any importance, they're there. And once these programs go up, they stay online forever. And there's no cutoff date. But of course, the wonderful thing about computer technology these days, it's the old 24 hours in a day limitation that used to lead to all of that internecine warfare at KPFA as to who had the time slots and who was at the album. And it's like. From a time standpoint, it's like John Cage said, everybody's in the best seat, and it's there forever.
Technology has definitely changed the world in a lot of ways. The only thing I think is people don't have enough time to really think about information. It's much more disposable and not contemplating. Mm-hmm. Taking an ocean voyage, you could have really thought about yourself and your life and the things you were doing. Now you're on an airplane, you get to the next place like I have in the last day on in another country, thousands of miles away, and I'm tired. And I haven't, contemplated anything particular.
Are you still working or are you retired?
No, I retired about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
The television industry was changing. I was not particularly happy with the way things were changing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided I'd stop. So I stopped. My wife and I actually moved out of the Bay Area. We moved up to Grass Valley,
mm-hmm.
a kind of small community. We're enjoying it.
Yeah, I remember that you moved. Of course, got your address. Did you getting back to KPFA just briefly? Did you feel that KPFA served as a in the technical side, in the engineering department, as a kind of to what degree was it an apprentice sort of thing? Did people were people able to learn technologically?
Yes. Yeah, it was quite possible for a young person, pretty much any age, to come in and say, like I did,
mm-hmm.
18 years or whatever, explain what I wanted to do with the then chief engineer. And when I was in that same position some years later, I was quite happy to have young men and women come in and have an interest in making stuff, repairing stuff, operating things. I wasn't so much in charge of the actual operational side, but was more involved with the remote collection of material, of music in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And after I left KPFA and went to KSAM, I had the same kind of program there. We had a whole bunch of young people that would come in. There we did rock and roll stuff
mm-hmm.
from the rock and roll clubs of the Bay Area.
Yeah.
That type of thing. We did the same thing. Young people would come in. We had teams of people. We did several live shows a week there from different clubs. So we had kind of two paid engineering people, and we must have had 10 interns that would go out with,
mm-hmm.
form a crew. It took
mm-hmm.
four or five people to haul equipment and do all the stuff. We didn't have the kind of portable, really portable stuff that they have today. The stuff is much bigger and bulkier. Pretty good sized team to do one of these projects. And we'd go in the afternoon and work with the band and figure out the mix and get it all sort of sorted out for the evening performance. Same kind of thing we did at KPFA. I mean, we would go to the, I think, remember one time we went to the Berkeley Community Theater and did the Santana band.
Oh, yeah.
We did the rehearsal. That was an interesting technical project because it was we were making an effort. We were stereo by that time. We were also trying to do quadraphonic. So we were doing four-channel things. So we would get together with another station and split the channels among them.
Oh, yeah. I remember KPFA and KPFB did a certain amount of quadraphonic that only a small number of people could listen to.
I don't think KPFB was ever stereo.
No, I was told that at one stage it did.
Well, it may have, but not while I was there.
Yeah, it may have been later on.
When I was there, it was the old RCA 250 watt transmitter. But that was, we had a concept of something we wanted to accomplish, and it was an experiment. We'd get together with, I think, Jim Gabbert's station, K101. We did some stuff. We did some stuff with KQED television or FM or perhaps
mm-hmm.
both.
Mm-hmm.
I know we did a television show, a Christmas show with those guys, with the Grateful Dead and some other groups, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of that stuff was very experimental. I mean, nobody had it sort of dialed in what to do with the channels and what to do with the microphones. We were kind of figuring that stuff out. And actually, I I enjoy doing that. I've been involved for quite a few years now, doing some 5.1 telecasts.
All right.
In fact, I did one just a few weeks ago for KTVU, which is where I was working until recently. I go back and do projects with them occasionally. We did a Chinese New Year's parade.
Did you in stereo? Did you work with M&S at all?
Yeah, we used the Neumann SM2 for doing MS coding. That was quite successful.
Yeah, because I don't know if Ambisonics reached over there at all.
The name is familiar. It's not a technique that I was involved with.
It's based essentially on the foundation of MS inside, and it's the microphone setup consists of at the second B format stage of it, it consisted of an Omni microphone, a figure eight crossways, a figure eight front to back, and a figure eight up and down, and these four channels were recorded on four tracks, which B format was, and out of these could be synthesized the exactly correct signal to be fed to an infinity of loudspeakers on a sphere. If you had the circuitry to do it, you could get just exactly the right signal to each one of these. In the simplest form, it was a four channel surround sound, just on a plane. It could get into paraphonics by adding another four tilted up, two up above, two at ground level. But you can imagine how if you take the mid and side principle of combining in phase and out of phase, and project this into front to back as well and up and down as well. The logic is just sort of patently obvious, and it all it makes itself, so to speak. I worked with Ambisonics for years and did a lot of recording with a Soundfield microphone, and with Electric Phoenix, a vocal group that I toured all over America and all over Europe with, we traveled with an Ambisonic four-speaker surround sound system, which was so compact that in those days we were able to take it with us as hold luggage on airplanes to America. And not pay any excess baggage for it. I had four expanding to eight when we were able to afford the transport. Meyer UPMs, the little tiny speakers. Two of those would go into a case which, in those days, classed as being within suitcase size and for American transport, along with the little preamp control units, And they didn't weigh them in those days. They only measured them. And I could set up a system in a hall. We could get going in a couple of hours, practically anywhere, with a surround sound system, and we were often working in dead sort of lecture halls that had no acoustic properties, no sound quality to them at all. But I also had one of those early Yamaha surround sound reverb units that they put out briefly for the domestic market, but they had an awful lot to build into them, and I could fairly convincingly convert a lecture hall into a cathedral. At least it would sound a bit primitive now. It's because one has become accustomed to such extraordinary, excellence and sound systems if it's done right. But then, compared with what one usually heard, and it was in the days when we had to travel with our own sound system, because most of the sound systems in most halls were so absolutely god-awful.
Yeah, it's much better if you can have your own stuff. Mm-hmm. No doubt about it.
But it was such fun.
I think that's why the great pianists have their own piano.
Yeah. Now, you must have overlapped with John Meyer at one point or another at KPFA.
I know him, but I don't remember in the KPFA Association.
Mm-hmm. Because he was, I don't know exactly what the relationship was, but he was essentially the son of, whether adopted or whatever, of Chuck Levy and Virginia Maynard. At KPFA, so he was, around on the fringes of the stages, the station from the earliest point. And you don't happen to know what the nature of that relationship was, whether he was adopted or what. But I do know that John Meyer got his start. Really, what sort of pushed him into prominence was designing sound systems for the Grateful Dead, and that was by way of the KPFA contact, from the very earliest stages. He sort of, in a way, ended up riding on the coattails of the Grateful Dead, the way that Buchla synthesizer sort of tied in with those people as well as they were climbing up, and so much of what happened as a result of the Grateful Dead grew out of their attitude towards commerciality, which was so totally laid back, and they used to encourage people to come in and do illicit recordings that weren't illicit because they were open. Anybody that wanted to record a concert, go ahead and do it. And they became, paradoxically, rich by giving things away, which was very close to the KPFA attitude. Except the KPFA never got rich.
seems like KPFA was the beginning of a lot of things. It was kind of a petri dish, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people could sort of have an idea and come there and form it, and they might stay there, or they might move to another venue, whatever. But it's a place that sort of nurtured all kinds of intellectual growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recorded an interview with Lawrence Ferlinghetti when I was over last time, you know, in 93, in the course of which he said that that when he came to when he first came to the Bay Area, that he got he had a doctorate from the Sorbonne, and he was obviously an educated person, but he said he felt he got his real education from listening to KPFA.
And that's then, a pretty high compliment.
Yeah, and then went on from there to give everybody else an education by appearing so often on the station.
A lot of the people that were involved in trying to educate people in a way or give their viewpoint. I mean, William Mandel had such a great gift and so much information. Had such a hard time with the government, and I mean, that was a really difficult period. All those hearings and stuff.
Yeah, I've got 2 hours of interview with him up on the, on that website, linking from the conversations page where I put up, like this, just talking to people about the station. I've got close to 50 hours of conversation up there with the ex-KPFA people, and mostly long. And I followed the advice of Elsa Knight Thompson on this, which was that so far as interviews were concerned, anybody worth talking to at all is worth talking to for an hour. She was, the ultimate anti-soundbite person.
It's one of the things I really dislike about contemporary media. They don't really ever get beyond the surface of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So many things in our world really require, like I was talking about earlier, you have to think about these things. You have to kind of do some digging and contemplation and stuff. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen in a 30-second soundbite. You get nothing. It's useless.
Yeah. That is one of the things about this Democracy Now! Program I was talking about. All of the people that they get on, it's unedited conversation going on for at least 20 minutes or so. And the more important people, they'll take up the whole hour with. It's an hour slot, basically, and how they split it up. One, two, or three.
That's a pretty decent length of time. You could accomplish a lot.
Yeah, compared with what television and radio normally give these days, it's infinity.
I don't know quite where this kind of mentality of the sound bite, and especially the kind of stuff where they take things out of context and try to make it appear that people are saying something that's not really what they said. So if you take out a portion of a sentence, it's incomplete. I don't know. It seems unethical and ridiculous to me.
Well, it all relates to time being money, squeezing as much in the way of commercials onto the air as one as one possibly can.
Somehow doing two things wrong doesn't seem to make it right to me.
But, you know, I really fear for our information sources now, because the foundation of investigative reporting has been newspapers,
right,
for
years
and years. They're going broke, just one after another.
The thing about a newspaper is you can get to know the writers and you can have a concept of who this person is talking to. Mm-hmm. Stuff on the internet, unattributed, is not very helpful. I mean, it's there, it's true, but it's not like the columnists that you read every week or every day. I mean, it's just not the same. I mean, there's some people out there that have some credibility, but a lot of it, who knows? Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's such loads of crap. Anybody at all can go up there and start a blog, there are millions of them out there, and most of them go inactive in a very short period of time.
Somehow KPFA has managed to soldier on for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard it in recent years. I'm not within signal range at this point. In fact, there's another station on the same frequency that's in our county.
Yeah.
So even if I had the inclination to reach for it with a big antenna, I don't think it would be possible.
Yeah, KPFA is very uneven now.
Of course, that was true
even then. but it even more uneven than ever. And they went through a period of political infighting where they were just tearing themselves to pieces. And then that worked out, got solved more or less for a short period of time, but now apparently they're at it again. There's this one guy that has written a couple of good books on KPFA history. Matthew Lazar. Does it ring a bell?
No.
I've got reviews of both of his up on my website, he wrote two very good books. The first one was a spin-off from his PhD dissertation, and it was the first half of the history up into the 70s, approximately 70s, 80s. Then he set out to bring it up to date with a book which was really necessarily about the internecine warfare of the worst, most destructive part of KPFA's history. And by that time, none of the major American publishers were interested. And he ended up being taken on by a small British publisher who brought out the book, and he had to do it in that old-fashioned method that used to be used back in the 19th century of subscription in advance, where you appealed to people to to buy copies in advance of the of the publication to guarantee the income. So he really had to struggle for it. And he's a professor now, you know, dealing with mostly with the history of broadcasting media, you know, in general. And he tells me he's not going to write anymore about Pacifica because nobody's interested enough to. That is to say, not enough people to make a publishing venture profitable. But first, at the moment, the publishers are in awful trouble, along with everybody else. And people I know in the restaurant business over in America telling me that is now in as dire straits as the housing business and the banks and the newspapers and everybody else.
Well, it's definitely a world economic.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It is.
Downturn at the moment.
It is. It's
worldwide. It's going to take a few honest people behave themselves to get us back on some kind of reasonable.
Well,
growth again.
Well,
people just took advantage of the situation, and it's not good.
The problem is that all of the people who are working on this, the economists are assuming that what they're dealing with is a normal sort of a cycle. It goes down and then it comes back up again. But what they are not taking into consideration is that we have not only the collapse of the free market system, which it has, but it's also we're headed into a total collapse of the world's energy supplies and water supplies and agricultural land supplies and accelerating global warming, and all of those coming together are not going to be solved by getting the banks going again. We're putting all of the money into the banks, and from there it's going straight into their pockets.
I think part of the problem is that they have models that they've used, and they're trying to look to that historical perspective.
Yeah.
And they're not really grasping that this is a different kind of situation, it's different dynamics. The other thing that most of these people can't seem to get through their heads is if they take an action, others will react to that reaction. I always think if we do this, then people are, if we raise this tax, then we're going to have this much money to do this. You don't realize when you raise the tax on beer, I'll drink wine, I'll drink water, I'll do something. I won't necessarily continue to do my life the way I did it yesterday. If you change a parameter, I'm going to look at it and I'm going to make a change. You know, all these economic models seem to miss that kind of feedback. Because that's kind of the line I've seen.
Yeah. There's an assumption that there is some situation called normal, and that when things go bad, it's like a departure from normality, but it'll get back to normal again because normal is the way that things usually are. The Roman Empire did not get back to normal. The Aztecs did not get back to normal. The Incas did not get back to normal.
Nope, they had to evolve.
No. They, they sort of disappeared and somebody else came along. Only this time there's nobody else to come along because this time it's the world.
Don't have an answer to that one.
Oh boy. Well, that's on that cheery note.